Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, part two of a classic talk by Michael Parenti. It's on imperialism, predatory capitalism, and the role of the news media in promoting both. I hope you'll stay tuned. Progressive political scientist Michael Parenti spoke at the University of Vermont on April 9, 1997. His topic was The Hidden Ideology of the News Media. We'll hear the second half of the talk this week. I think Parenti was at his funniest and most enjoyable in the 1990s. And he has always been and remains very sharp and very perceptive. He's one of the few commentators who can make current events make sense. What's remarkable is how little has changed since 1997. Only the names and sometimes the countries have changed, and sometimes not even that. Case in point, Parenti starts off today talking about former U.S. puppet Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. Eventually, the puppet Gaddafi annoyed the U.S. by acting too independent, and suddenly the whole U.S. news media and government were denouncing him as the Hitler of the Middle East. Actually, North Africa, but close enough for the Washington Post. The U.S. and NATO bombed Libya. This was back in 1986. Parenti talks about this round of anti-Gaddafi hysteria in the U.S. A funny thing happened afterwards. Gaddafi stayed in power, and the U.S. forgot that he was the Hitler of the Middle East. And everybody got along fine for the next 25 years. Then, in 2011, Gaddafi suddenly became Hitler again, and was allegedly gassing his own people and allegedly raping virgin Christian girls, etc., etc. NATO launched another big bombing campaign, and we aided Libyan rebels in overthrowing the government and killing Gaddafi. Like Iraq, Libya has been a shambles ever since, and now we're doing exactly the same thing to Assad of Syria. The names change, but the road goes on forever, and the party never ends. From 1997, here again is Michael Parenti.
One of the ways in which the media serve as the stenographers for power, or the mouthpieces for power, is the way they so eagerly and quickly, as if on cue, demonize a foreign leader who might be targeted by U.S. military intervention. I'll give you three examples in recent years. By recent years, I mean from the 1980s and 1990s. Gaddafi of Libya, Noriega of Panama, and Saddam Hussein of Iraq. Now, what those three leaders had in common is, in their quite different ways, were charting a rather independent course for their country. These three guys were demonized within a matter of weeks, you know. Gaddafi, I remember, Libya. I'd go around talking, people would be Gaddafi, and what about Gaddafi, what about Gaddafi, Gaddafi, Gaddafi going to get your mama, Gaddafi under your bed, watch out, Gaddafi. I say, what are you preoccupied by Gaddafi? There's one reason you're preoccupied by Gaddafi, not because he's a threat to you, but because the media has been pumping you with stories about him. 2 months ago when they weren't doing this, nobody was you weren't talking about Gaddafi. You were going to bed, going to sleep, had a nice night. You didn't worry if he was under your bed or not. Now you're Gaddafi. And when they stop talking about him, you'll stop worrying about him again. It's kind of scary. I remember that with Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put in Iraq by the CIA. He was a right-wing military guy. He exterminated the Kurdish Independent Party. He exterminated the Iraqi Communist Party. I mean, this guy was not particularly good news. But he also did some other things. He was developing the country. He trained a whole cadre of engineers. He put out an education plan. And he was fighting for an independent course on the oil pricing. And that was his mistake. And Bush went after him. So we now find even a conservative nationalist, if he's an independent nationalist and doesn't act like a purely comprador ruler, that is, a ruler who is a client state leader of U.S. corporate American imperialism, the kind of ruler who says, come on in, boys, it's all yours, do what you want with the country, there's no development, there's no occupational safety laws, there's no minimum wage laws, there's no unions, or they're very small, very weak, if they get out of line, we'll beat the hell out of them with our civil guard, our guard who are trained, financed, equipped, and advised by you. And you come on in, invest in cheap labor, your profit level, your value-added level, the rates are 3-4 times what they'll be in Ohio or California. Close your factory there. Come on here. Open it up here. It's all yours. That's the kind of leaders they want. And when they get a leader who charts an independent course, and that's Noriega of Panama, he said, I got $10 million from the CIA. Noriega was CIA. It's no accident that Trujillo, his boss, the military leader who took over in Panama and took back the Panama Canal, and then started all sorts of reforms, human service programs, education for the common people. It's no accident that less than a year after Reagan got into office, Trujillo's plane exploded in midair. A bomb blew him to pieces, and Noriega was put in his place. But Noriega still had the Panamanian military, was a rather a progressive one, a nationalist, populist military, and there were limits to what he could do. And when he started refusing to do what the CIA want on drug deals and on anti-Sandinista moves, that's when they went after him. And the media report him as called him a jungle rat. I remember Dan Rathers, the liberal Dan Rathers, saying, Noriega, we call him a swamp rat. The swamp rat, Noriega, crafty and full of guile, like he's an expert on swamp rats. We never heard anything. So you turn to your fellow Americans, you say, how could a country, Libya, a country with which a short time ago you couldn't even find on the map, headed by a guy whose name we still can't all agree on how to spell or even pronounce, with a population of 3 million, 3 million, and a ragtag army of 50,000, how can that country be a mortal threat to the survival and interests of the United States? It's not a mortal threat to us. It was a threat to the oil companies, that's all. His unspeakable sin was he and his colonels led a colonel's rebellion in 1968 in a country that had a social structure like Saudi Arabia, our wonderful ally Saudi Arabia today. That is a country that had mass poverty and a few obscenely rich families that had hundreds of billions of dollars more money than knew what to do with. He took over that country and he started to use that money for social programs. 40 million trees planted in forestation programs, education programs, health clinics set up, roads put in, and the like. And he nationalized the oil industry. He took it from the big oil companies. He said, the oil is in our land. The people who live on this land should get something for it. He still sells the oil to us at relatively the same price. It's no loss to you and me. The loss is to Exxon and Mobil. For half a century, the CIA and other covert agencies have involved themselves in political assassinations and death squads that have killed tens of thousands of people in Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Bolivia, Colombia, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, and you can go on. And the killings were not random. The killings were of liberation theology clergy, of union leaders, of student leaders, peasant leaders, co-op leaders, and people like this. Anybody who was doing anything to try to organize the ordinary, common, poor people to better their lives, become active social agents of their own lives, those were the people killed. And it's a very rational and very correct policy, because I, who make money and get rich off your labor, want you demoralized and disorganized. I don't want you organized. I don't want you well-educated. I don't want you conscious and informed and militant. I don't want you being able and capable of defending your own interests. The hungrier you are, the more willing you will work for harder and harder for less and less. And the harder you work for less and less, the more I make and the richer I make. For half a century, the CIA has been involved in drug trafficking and alliances. They were involved with the Golden Triangle. They had a whole
airplane company. It was called Air America, wasn't it? Air America. It was a CIA-run airplane company directly involved with taking the heroin out and bringing it to that big, rich American market, the first one. Do you know which one that was? It was the GIs in Vietnam. You got 300,000 guys there living on the edge, desperate, bored, homesick, miserable, frightened, and with money. That's a drug market, man. That was the first big drug market the CIA cultivated, was their own American soldiers in Vietnam. It's no accident that so many of those Vietnam vets came back with drug problems. And they had Air America flying it from those hill country Hmong tribes and these others who were supposedly anti-Vietnamese, anti-communist, and they were our allies. I mean, that's a matter of public record, for Christ's sake. Senator Church's committee discovered that in the 70s. Congressman Otis Pike's Joint Congressional Committee in the late 70s. Senator Kerry's committee in the 80s about cocaine from Latin America. Again, the CIA involved. Heroin from Afghanistan. The CIA was involved with that. I know that. You know where I read it? I read it in a secret document. You know what the secret document was? The Washington Post. Right out there. Last, right out there on page 23, paragraph 42, it said, the CIA supported war is proving successful against the Soviets. The Mujahideen are coming back and taking over their lands. And with this, the opium trade has increased. And we can expect an increase in the heroin that is flooded in American cities. I said, wasn't that interesting? Just written like that, as if it was a weather report. Can you imagine if that was the Sandinistas doing that, or Libya? Or Cuba. My God, it would have been all over the papers for years. Here it was on page 23, paragraph 45. There's a couple of sentences. Now, this is all, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this is all a matter of public record. Three congressional committees have had the guys come forward. Felix Rodriguez comes forward before the Carey Committee and said, how much did you handle? He said, I handled about $10 million in cash a week. Said, who with? Senator Alphonse D'Amato. D'Amato's elegance and form and style. Says, wow, who with? Who? What'd you do that with? Said, well, with the executive and military leaders of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Colombia, Venezuela, Mexico. D'Amato says, how'd you get out of those countries with that kind of money? How'd you get past customs? Really, Senator, when you're carrying $10 million, you don't go through customs. You know, they have limousines and helicopters waiting for you. And they say, I mean, I saw all this. I saw these guys get up and say, yeah, we got on these planes and we flew down there with guns. And then we loaded up with cocaine and we came back to the city, came back to the U.S. The interesting slip there, the city. You know, I remember when cocaine was an upper-class and upper-middle-class drug. I mean, it's what New York executives, Hollywood guys used and all that sort of thing. Coke was a chic and expensive recreational drug. And so it was people of a certain class. It was called the recreational drug. Suddenly, in the 80s, it appears on the streets in bargain prices in concentrated form as crack. Goes to all these different inner city people. And again, they want a African-American population that is not organized, getting militant, getting politically conscious as it was in the 60s with the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, Chicanos, the Brown Berets, all these different people. They don't want that. They want people who are disorganized, demoralized, drug-ridden, crime-ridden, young men who are not challenging the powers that be because they're too busy shooting each other up with guns and themselves up with needles. And so it worked very well. It also then gave them money to pursue their mercenary forces. This is a story that's been pretty much buried and killed in the media. Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News just this past year, again, after a year's investigation, this is journalism at its best. This is journalism at its best. Found CIA operatives who said, yes, we worked with Crips and Bloods inner city leaders in L.A., brought the crack in there and took the money out for the CIA. He put all that on the internet, by the way. It got around so much. And look what the media did. They came out and saying, there's no evidence for it. There's never been any evidence for this. I mean, just outright blatant lies. Three congressional committees have given you all the evidence in the world, and the media comes in, and when their first line of suppression doesn't work, and the first line of suppression and distortion, the most common line, is omission. You just don't report it. When that doesn't work and the story gets out, gets on the internet, or some other thing happens, or there's demonstrations, or congressional committee decides to discuss law, then they come out and they destroy the target. And they say, Webb is not a particularly good journalist, this, that, and that. He has no evidence for it. He thinks the whole CIA. They accused him of having said things he never said. That's the way the media worked. Listen, if that kind of thing went on in some countries, that would be called totalitarian control. Senator Church found that every major news organization and outlet was penetrated by the CIA, that some 400 journalists, editors, and publishers were connected to the CIA. 400, that's a goodly number. There's a massive assault on government human services programs, and this has been given relatively little play in the media, except when it's doing the government's bidding. For instance, the word that's out is that certain things need reform. Welfare needed to be reformed. Now notice the use of certain terms, too, reform. These are the disinforming euphemisms that are used. Welfare wasn't reformed, it was savaged. It was destroyed. I mean, if I come over to your house and I say, you know, your house needs some rehabbing, needs a little reform, and then I level it with a bulldozer, I mean, wouldn't you be piqued? Wouldn't you feel deceived? And now we hear that same word again, Social Security. We've got to reform Social Security. Why, in 15 years, it'll be bankrupt. Ladies and gentlemen, I remember 1981 when Reagan was in office, and they said, in 15 years, Social Security will be bankrupt. It was running a surplus of $30, $40 billion then. It's still running a surplus today. Of course, they raised the Social Security tax, too. But the point is, it's at least 15 years later, it isn't bankrupt at all. It's 16 years later. It's not bankrupt. It's still running a surplus. It's a lie. But they convince people, they from the beginning, say, well, this is going to happen, and therefore we've got to change it. The truth of the matter is that Social Security is a program that works, and it works very well, and it works for you too. You may think you're too young to worry about it, but when you're in your middle years and trying to raise your own family, do you want parents who are broke, or do you want parents who have some Social Security pension and some means of income for themselves? And Social Security is not just an old age pension. It has three components to it. It has old age retirement support. It has survivor's support for any family of any age. If the breadwinner are killed, one or two, the people who are left destitute or indigent get Social Security. They can be 18 years old and they can collect Social Security. And the third component of it is disability. It has a disability insurance. If you're hit in an accident and you suffer disability and this puts a limit on your earning powers, you can collect Social Security. This is what they want to now dismantle. And the media is going along with it. The media begins by assuming the argument. The very thing that has to be argued and debated is already assumed. And they say, well, we all know that it needs reforming. We all know that it isn't working. It's working perfectly. In 50 years, they've never missed paying out a check. They handle $300 billion a year. And it means the difference between destitution and some measure of dignity for millions of elderly people and hundreds of thousands of disabled people. You'd never know that from the way the media treats that subject. One of the interesting things about the media personnel is the revolving door. They go from government to corporations, back to the media to government. Leslie Gelb was in corporate America, then he was in State Department, then he was a Washington Post, then he's a, I think he's Post, yeah. And now he's back in government. Diane Sawyer, she was with the Nixon administration, and now she's a media personality. She went off with Pat and Dick to California when he retired to help him write his memoirs. And now we see her on ABC. Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan was a columnist, a far right-wing columnist. Then he went in and became a speechwriter for the Nixon administration. Then he was out again as a commentator, a journalist. And then he was in with the Reagan administration. And now he's out and he's a journalist again. So he's been either a journalist or a White House flack for his whole life. In other words, in his whole life, he's never had an honest job. You know? Pete Williams. I remember Pete Williams. He was in that film I mentioned to you, Panama Deception, which I'm partial to because I'm in it too. I was being interviewed in that film, and Pete Williams kept coming on. Pentagon spokesman. Now, this is an objective journalist, right? The Pentagon spokesman would say, look, El Chorrillo neighborhoods in Panama have been bombed by U.S. planes. 3,000 people killed. He says, I have no evidence of that. We'd run, cut in and run footage, and you see these houses burning and all that, and the bodies lying there. I know of no such atrocities. Pete Williams leaves the Pentagon, and he is now national correspondent for NBC. Now, if you had some other country where this was happening, where people were working 1 year for Pravda, the next year for the KGB, next year in the foreign ministry, the next year for Pravda again, why, you'd say, boy, they don't have an independent press. Boy, that's really totalitarian, isn't it? Right. Now, reporters fall into two kinds. When I wrote my book, Inventing Reality, I talked to reporters and interviewed some of them. There are those who will say to you, oh, yes, you have to have very finely attuned antenna as to just how far you could go, and if you go any further, they'll zap you. And then there are others, and usually those were ex-reporters. Those are ones who used to be with Associated Press, or used to do this, used to that, and they're no longer doing that. The other ones are the other 97% of the reporters I've run into, and journalists and editors and such. They're the ones who get very indignant that you suggest that they are influenced by anything other than their own discerning, independent insight, you see. Are you telling me that I'm not my own man? I'll have you know that in 20 years with this newspaper, I always said what I like. And I answer, you say what you like because they like what you say. And you have no sensation of being repressed because your views are perfectly coterminous with those of your boss. Your unexamined assumptions, your use of terms like reform and swamp rat and whatever else are exactly the kind of stuff they want to hear. It fits. Your ideological perspective is theirs. So you don't have any sensation of restraint. You know, if you have a leash around your neck, but you spend your whole life sitting by the peg, you don't feel restrained. It's only when you try to stray to a forbidden parameter that suddenly you feel the tug. As I felt, why, right on this very campus 25 years ago. Nicholas Johnson gives the case of the four stages of the socialization of a journalist. In stage one, the young, dedicated, idealistic reporter goes out and he investigates something and he writes this expose about local power guys who also happen to be big advertisers for the newspaper. And he comes back and he shows it to his editor and the editor says, no, that's silly, we can't do that. No, that won't fly. Stage two, he doesn't go out and write it. He gets another idea about something that should be looked into, but he goes talk to the editor first, and the editor says, no, forget it. Forget that. Stage three, he gets the idea, and then he dismisses it himself and says, nah, that's silly. And in stage four, he no longer gets the idea, no longer critically looks at that. And I added stage five. Stage five, he gets on panels with media critics like me and gets very indignant if I suggest that there are influences on him and all that. Well, if it's true that the news is so conservative and so serves the powers that be, why do conservatives keep attacking it as a liberal media? Why not? Keeps it on its toes, keeps it leaning to the right, dressing to the right, keeps it from going too far over to this side. Why not? Of course. And furthermore, for conservatives, for a far-right group, there are things that they don't want to see that are in the regular media. See, if the right-wing ideologues had their way completely, they would want the average newspaper to just be story after a celebration of the free market, the wonders and glories of free market capitalism, a few anti-communist horror stories, lots of crime in there, and then some cooking recipes, crossword puzzle, comics, and all that. Which, by the way, describes a lot of newspapers in America. We used to have one here that attacked me every other day. Burlington Free Press. Is it still around, the Burlington Free Press? We used to call it the Burlington Repress. They had a really terrible right-wing editor in those days named Frank Smith. He was the last editor in America to keep defending Richard Nixon before Nixon left the White House in disgrace for the Watergate thing. The New York Times would run his op-eds because they couldn't find anyone else willing to defend Nixon. That was Frank Smith. There's another problem conservatives do face. To some extent, the media does have to sometimes report hard news. Even their own ruling elites want to know some things that are going on. And when they report hard news, that gets them sort of close to the real world. And when they get close to the real world, you find that the real world is radical. The real world is leftist. It's not that we leftists make up these things. I don't mean that people out in the real world are radical or leftist. I mean the events that we talk about are real. It's not a leftist ideological argument that people are getting downsized and downgraded. It's the real world that's actually happening. It's not a leftist ideological propaganda view that the CEOs and the top 1% of the population are now enjoying a concentration of wealth that's 100% higher than it was 20 years ago. That happens to be an objective fact. We didn't make that up. We only discover it. It's the leftists who want to propagate it and want to publicize it a lot more. It's not a leftist ideological propaganda theme that children in Indonesia, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Haiti are working every day for 10, 12 cents an hour, 12 hours a day, that 300, 400 million children in the world are working, children in India, in the sex industry, in carpet industry, going blind, going lame, going every other thing without any kind of protections. That's not something we made up. That's something that the right will suppress because it reflects poorly on capital, and that's something that's real and it's out there. And to the extent that the media ever takes notice of a toxic waste dump or something like that, or waste in the Pentagon or something like that, that's when the conservatives say, you see, it's a liberal conspiracy to make corporate America look bad. That's terrible. You shouldn't be talking about those things. And you must talk about them probably because you're a leftist or a liberal. No, they mention it every so often because that's reality. Reality is radical. George Bush called that class war, when we start to criticize the rich and powerful who abuse us and human labor and the environment. He calls that class war. See, whenever we fight back, whenever ordinary people fight back, we're called waging class war. They're doing class war all the time on our heads. The minute we fight back against it, they go, oh, that's class war. You're being divisive, and you mustn't do that. Yeah, divisive, just like rebellious slaves were being divisive. That they were being divisive. They were disrupting the beauty and harmony of the magnolia piece of the plantation. And that's us, folks. You can call that class war, this fighting back, this agitating. But I have another word for it also. It is class war, but it's something else. When people act as the active social agents of their own lives, I have another word for that. That's called democracy. Uh-huh. Democracy, democracy, and let's have more of it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
A huge round of applause for Michael Parenti on The Hidden Ideology of the News Media from April 1997. I snipped out a few minutes from part two to make the talk fit our time slot. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum. Remember that war is not healthy for children and other living things. And please come back again next week. Ciao.